Hello, everybody. This is Keith Pannell, and welcome back to Science Studio. Today I'm here, and my occasional co-host has turned up today, Russ Chianelli. We're going to be talking about how cancer spread once you've got cancer in one part of your body. How does it sort of distribute itself and metastasize around? But we do have an expert today who is going to enlighten us about these things, but also talk about some of the big ethical dilemmas that come to scientists working in the field of medicine and curative issues. And Russ, who's our guest?
We're very happy to welcome to Science Studio Dr. Robert S. Kerbel. He's a senior scientist at the Molecular and Cellular Biology Research Center at Sunnybrook Health Sciences Center in Toronto, Canada. Welcome to Science Studio, Bob.
Glad to be here.
Before we get into the oncology area, the ethics of trying to treat disease, because there are major issues there, how did you yourself get into the career of a scientist?
Well, serendipitously, through the back door, side door, basement, whatever. I really did not think about a career in research, cancer research or research at all. Until, and this is sort of indirectly, I was an undergraduate at the University of Toronto. And in the second year of doing a Bachelor of Science degree, I was taking a chemistry course, physical, organic, whatever, organic chemistry.
Do you remember the faculty member?
I don't. I slept in for most of the lectures. But
so that was probably Keith Yates.
But in any event... One of the things that sort of caught my eye was that when I was taking, you know, labs, and there were lab demonstrators who were obviously graduate students. Maybe they might have been postdoctoral fellows. I don't remember. Probably mostly graduate students. And there was something about being trained by them, you know, that just caught my fancy. I thought, I'd like to do that. I'd like to work in a university. I'd like to be a professor. But really what I was thinking mostly about was teaching, not necessarily doing research. And one reason for that is that I thought, you know, to be a successful scientist, you probably would have to be incredibly brilliant, probably somewhat eccentric, and work like a dog. And I thought, I'm none of those things, you know, so... And my marks were actually not all that great in the first 2 years of the University of Toronto. But in the third year, interestingly enough, I took an immunology course. And this is a classic example where somebody's sort of drifting around. You don't have any self-confidence. You're wondering what you're going to do. You know, all your friends at that time, my friends were going into dental school, medical school, law school, business school. And I didn't want to do any of those things. But on the other hand, I didn't know what I really wanted to do. Then I took this immunology course and I thought,
That's it.
So I aced the course. I did extremely well. And then I took another, you know, fourth year of undergraduate work. And after the fourth year, and the fourth year and the third year, my marks were really good at the University of Toronto, pretty good.
So basically it was finding the niche in science.
That was part of it. Then there's the issue of luck. So what happened is that at the end of the fourth year, I went to see the professor who had taught the immunology course in which I had done extremely well. And I knocked on his door and I said, listen, I'd like to do a master's degree in your lab in immunology. And so he said, come on in, sit down. And the first thing he asked me was, do you have your transcripts with you, your marks? And I said, yeah, I do. And I pulled out the transcripts and, you know, he looked at them and he said, you know, I don't think you will be accepted by the School of Graduate Studies in the University of Toronto because of your first 2 years. And if you are accepted, the likelihood of you getting any kind of a scholarship that would cover your stipend or your salary or whatever would be almost zero. So he said, I'm sorry, I can't take you. Now, at that time in Canada, there were some very interesting things going on in cancer immunology at McGill University in Montreal. And so I thought, you know what, I'll just get in my little sports car, my little Fiat sports car, and I'll drive to Montreal. It's a 5-hour drive. And I'll just walk in and I'll see these guys. who were doing some pioneering work at McGill and see if I could wangle my way in to do a master's degree. Off I set, this is true, to go to Montreal. And halfway to Montreal, there's this little town called Kingston, Ontario. There's a university there called Queen's University. And as I was driving by Kingston, I thought, you know, we had a couple of professors who gave guest lectures at that immunology and microbiology course that I had taken in third year at the University of Toronto. So I made a quick right turn, drove down to Queen's University, eventually found it, parked my car, and I started hunting around for the microbiology and immunology department. I didn't know where it was, and somebody said, it's in the new medical building, just around there. So I started walking around looking for a new medical building, and I couldn't find a new medical building because it was built in 1868. eventually I found it, sure enough, when you walked into this building, you thought Louis Pasteur is going to come around the corner any second. I walked up one flight of stairs, saw a sign of a name of a guy, deputy director of the Department of Microbiology and Immunology. I knocked on the door, introduced myself. I said, I want to do a master's degree in immunology. He came, you know, he said, come in, sit down. And the first thing he asked me is, do you have your university transcripts on you with you? So I thought, oh, here we go again. And I pulled out my transcripts and he looked at them. And he went up and down the page and he said, wow, these marks are excellent.
So that was it.
I said, this is it. I'm not going to Montreal. I found. And then he said to me something about your salary will be whatever it was back then. Now, I this is how naive I was. I thought, when you go to graduate school, you're still going to school. They're paying me to go to school, and they think my marks are really good. I'm here. I accepted it. And you know, interestingly enough, I really did it with the intention of just doing a master's degree. And then, I don't know, whatever happened, maybe I would end up and maybe I would go to medical school or something else. And the first 6 months of doing this master's degree in immunology were awful. Things weren't working out. The experiments, I thought, this is not for me. It's very common, I think, for students, especially when they start, not to be, to lack self-confidence. They look at others who are more experienced or the professors. How am I ever going to measure up to these people? And then one day I walked into the cold room. I had just finished doing an experiment overnight the previous day, looked at the results, changed my life from then on because something worked. I had discovered something that no one else had ever seen before. And I thought, this is it. And started to go on and got it. And then I was asked to reclassify into a PhD program. Forget the master's degree. Do you want to do a PhD? Right. Did that. Finished in 3.5 years. Did extremely well. Published 3 or 4 papers. Then did a postdoctoral fellowship in London, England. And then got a job at the same university where I had done this graduate training. I never actually had to look for a position.
Let me ask you another question, which always I discuss with chemistry students too. When I was getting my chemistry degree in New York City, and I had a really good opportunity to go to medical school, and I just thought that was a really dumb idea going to medical school. Did you ever have that crisis between studying science and going to medical school?
No, I didn't. And there's another joke about that because, I only thought about it from the point of view of what else am I going to do? If the science thing doesn't work out, and all my friends, so many of them were going to medical school, it was like a default position. But, you know, my mother once said to me that my greatest contribution to mankind were the countless thousands of lives I saved by not going to medical school. So that was the kind of confidence she had in me. You know, science, yeah, go ahead, maybe, but forget about anyway, so I didn't really think seriously about it.
Well, two things come out of this, right? First of all, if you hadn't had a little Fiat sports car, but something that was perhaps more reliable, that you knew you could get to Montreal, maybe you would never have stopped in Kingston. But the second thing is, the experiment that was suddenly successful, what was that? What was that particular experiment? What did you learn?
Well, that experiment involved, at that time, the research in immunology was taking a major interesting turn. it was already known at that time that the cells in the body that were responsible for making antibodies were called B lymphocytes. B lymphocytes. And about a year or two before, some groups in Australia and England and elsewhere discovered another type of lymphocyte derived from the thymus gland. So these were called thymus-derived lymphocytes or T cells. And just around the time that I started to do graduate work, there was a lot of interest in how T lymphocytes and B lymphocytes spoke to each other, how they communicated to, you know, bring about aspects of the immune system and what it does. And there was a growing interest in the idea that these T cells, that B cells would make antibodies, but the T cells did not make antibodies. They were doing something else. Well, what exactly what were they doing? And there was some suggestion at the time that T cells were actually, some of them were capable of killing viruses, infected cells, or maybe even killing cancer cells. So T cells were looked upon at that time, again, it was early days, as a good thing. And there was a lot of interest in sort of trying to ramp them up. But what I had discovered from that experiment is that there might be examples of T cells that actually had a suppressive effect on the immune system rather than just a stimulatory effect. And so really, I guess I was involved fairly early on in what were called suppressor T cells. They're now called T regulatory cells.
So in other words, that these T cells couldn't distinguish between an invader and something inside.
Well, the theory was is that they could actually distinguish between – they may be able to distinguish between an invader and so forth. But the idea was that was being developed at the time is that once – the immune system becomes activated. Say B cells start making antibodies and T cells start ramping up and becoming killer cells. You have to have some kind of mechanism to turn those guys off eventually. You don't want them to keep going and going and going. It's like a homeostatic feedback mechanism. Because if they keep going, then you might run into problems like autoimmune disease. So in fact, these suppressor T cells were sort of viewed as just part of a system of like gas pedals and brakes. And these were the brakes. This has actually become incredibly important now in cancer treatment and cancer immunology.
And you were the first person to find that?
No, I was not the first person, but I'm saying that we were early on. I discovered an aspect. Let's put it this way. I discovered an aspect of T cells, of suppressor T cells, that could affect the ability of B cells to do their thing. So I didn't discover suppressor T cells, but I discovered, let's say, as a young graduate student, a new aspect of what they might be able to do.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell. I'm here with co-host today, Russ Chianelli. And we're talking to Robert Kerbel from the Sunnybrook Health Science Center in Toronto, Canada. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Neisel. Can the way you were born affect your health? A new finding says it's possible that cesarean birth can change a baby's DNA compared to babies born vaginally.
We don't know if these differences are permanent, but the study makes us want to take a closer look. Because one out of three babies in America is born by C-section, and the rate is nearly half in China. Some are for medical reasons, but many are medically unjustifiable.
So far, the procedure has been associated with increased rates of diseases such as type 1 diabetes and obesity. And the latest study shows epigenetic changes in the DNA of cesarean babies.
What is epigenetics? Basically, it's when genes are turned on or off, sometimes due to environmental effects such as smoking. We now also know these changes can be passed on to newborns.
This change to the DNA occurs through a mechanism called DNA methylation. Cells use this mechanism to lock genes in an off position when they no longer need it to be expressed. For example, to stop new teeth growth. But the same mechanism can work against us when a gene that should be on is switched off.
In the new study, with two groups of babies, one vaginally born, another through C-section, their stem cells were compared for DNA methylation.
They found methylation changes in more than 300 regions of the genome between the two groups, mostly in areas associated with the immune system. Again, we don't know if these methylation changes in the C-section babies are permanent.
The theory is that natural childbirth is stressful to the baby, which could be an environmental signal to prep the baby for life outside the womb. A C-section baby would not experience that, but it's early yet to declare they should.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Professor Robert Kerbel from the Sunnybrook Research Institute in Toronto, Canada, associated with Sunnybrook Hospital. And we've been talking about his early entry into science and his results as a graduate student on T-cell sort of science. Now, you've come a long way since that. That was 40 years, 50 years ago. Tell us exactly, I know that you're well known for something that is becoming called metronomic therapy. And I think the audience would be very interested in this whole concept of treating, in this case, cancers with this metronomic approach.
Well, it may be the best way to describe what is meant by the term metronomic chemotherapy. It would be useful to go back and say a little bit about how historically and to this day, for that matter, chemotherapy is normally given or administered to patients. And the concept in oncology, not just for chemotherapy drug, but for many other types of drug, is the most you can give, that's the best thing to do. More is better. And drugs are often developed in oncology on the basis of what's called the maximum tolerated dose. And the way this is defined early on is you take you do what's called a phase one clinical trial, and you take groups, cohorts of patients, three apiece, and you take your new drug, whatever it is, and you keep upping the dose in these cohorts until you get to a point where literally a patient can no longer tolerate that dose. It's just too toxic. So you back down a little bit from that dose, and that by definition is the maximum amount that you can give to most patients, the maximum tolerated dose. Then you take that forward into further clinical development, phase two clinical trials, where you now ask, does that maximum tolerated dose of drug X, does it actually have a hint or more of working? Does it have what we call efficacy? And if it does, then you move it forward into the large double-blind, placebo-controlled, randomized phase three clinical trial where you might have, you know, thousands of patients or hundreds of patients per arm. Now, the problem or one problem with a maximum tolerated dose is what's called the therapeutic index or therapeutic ratio. And what that refers to is, okay, you give more drug, logically, intuitively, you think you're going to get more tumor cells being killed. And that actually is often the case. But the problem is you also get more normal cells in various tissues and organs in the body also being affected. So you can only, again, go so high. And what you're looking for is the best therapeutic index you get. By that I mean a drug, let's say that it would have a superb therapeutic index, the holy grail in oncology, is it only kills tumor cells and doesn't do anything at all to normal cells. No such thing exists. There is no such thing in oncology. And that's really one of the major problems about drug development in oncology is getting this specificity. So a major problem with the maximum tolerated dose concept is, yes, it can work. You can debulk, you know, tumors, but there's this issue of it doesn't work for very long. Tumors often become resistant to that way of giving therapy, and then there's the toxicity.
That particular maximum tolerable dose was going to vary from patient to patient.
After the trial, then
when it goes into practice, then the oncologist has to play that same game with each individual
yes and no. I mean, that's actually a great question because there are certain drugs that are given in a standard flat dose. It doesn't matter, you know, what your body size or weight is. And because of the way each individual patient metabolizes drugs and so forth, the maximum tolerated dose for patient A may not be the maximum tolerated dose for patient B. And there always has been a suspicion that some patients are actually being overdosed or underdosed when they get the recommended maximum tolerated dose of a certain, you know, drug.
And the reason why the oncologist can't play that game, is that to do with rules and regulations and laws?
Well, I think one of the problems is it just becomes a much more difficult thing to implement in the clinic. Like, let's supposing you're a really busy oncologist, and most oncologists are overburdened and really busy. Now, supposing they say they see 10 patients, breast cancer patients, who are getting, let's say, the same therapy or a similar therapy in a given day, it would be easier just to give them the same dose. But if you have to figure out a way with each patient what the correct dose is for that treatment on that day, you can imagine how much more difficult it is. So it's an issue of practicality. Okay. But there are efforts now being made to implement what you're saying, which is maybe there are some ways that you can adjust the dose of a certain drug in a patient over time. And ironically, the way this is being done in some cases is toxicity. So let me give you a quick example of what I mean. The type of drug, they're called anti-angiogenic drugs. So they are not meant to kill tumor cells directly. They're meant to cut off the tumor's lifelines, the blood vessels that are feeding tumors. There's this process called angiogenesis, new blood vessel formation in tumors. Now, these anti-angiogenic drugs, they have very common side effects. For example, fatigue, hypertension, very common side effect with these anti-angiogenic drugs. Now, there's an oncologist that I'm working with in Toronto whose name is Georg Bjarnason, originally from Iceland. He treats kidney cancer patients with these anti-angiogenic drugs. And he began to think, along with some other kidney cancer specialists a few years ago, that, you know, it's probably the case that a certain fraction of his patients, kidney cancer patients, are being underdosed with these anti-angiogenic drugs. Why? Because some of the patients who would get the standard flat dose and schedule of the drug were not showing any significant hypertension. They were not showing any fatigue, whereas some others were obviously showing a lot of hypertension. And he and others reasoned, you know, maybe those patients that are not showing these side effects, the reason is because of the way they metabolize the drug or whatever, you know, other factors, they're not getting enough drug. That's why they're not responding to the drug. So he has designed a trial based on some results that were published, retrospective results. There's now a prospective trial in Canada that is doing exactly, Keith, what you have just mentioned. He individualizes the dose and the schedule on an ongoing basis for every patient that is enrolled in this trial.
That's real personal medicine.
It is a great example of personalized medicine. Exactly right.
Okay, look, we haven't even got yet. Go now then to the metronomic
chemotherapy.
Yeah, metronomic
chemotherapy. So the idea behind metronomic chemotherapy, I don't really have time to go into the entire rationale, but what we and Judah Folkman, who's the father of the field of anti-angiogenic therapy in cancer, we had been discussing for some years the idea that chemotherapy drugs, this is something that I began to think about and wrote a paper on in 1990. You know, Dr. Folkman and there were other groups and other companies that were trying to develop anti-angiogenic drugs. Could we find something different about the blood vessels and tumors and shut them down selectively and, again, not harm blood vessels elsewhere in the body, okay? So there was this hunt going on for anti-angiogenic drugs. And I had a discussion with Dr. Folkman and I said, well, maybe oncologists have been using anti-angiogenic drugs without knowing it for years, chemotherapy. Why? Well, because, you know, again, a lot of the side effects of chemotherapy are due to these drugs destroying, inhibiting the proliferation of rapidly dividing cells in the body. That's what they target. Hair follicle cells, your hair falls out. Bone marrow progenitor, so you have neutropenia, myelosuppression. So during the process of a new blood vessel forming, some of the cells that line those blood vessels are dividing. And so I thought, well, when a patient who has cancer gets chemotherapy, maybe one of the side effects, a good side effect of that chemotherapy would be killing those dividing endothelial cells in a newly forming what's called angiogenic blood vessel. And so Dr. Folkman and I discussed this, and then I said to Dr. Folkman in a phone conversation, but there's something that doesn't make sense about this. You know, for example, kidney cancer. It's a highly angiogenic tumor. Lots of new blood vessels being made in kidney cancer. And at that time, and still to this day, there's virtually no known successful chemotherapy for kidney cancer. So it didn't seem to make sense, this idea that I had. Well, some years later, Dr. Folkman came up with an idea. He said, you know what? In mice, when you give chemotherapy at the maximum tolerated dose to tumor-bearing mice, you can actually see in the tumor evidence of an anti-vascular effect in the tumor. You can see these blood vessel endothelial cells dying, all right? But the problem is when you give the drug at the maximum tolerated dose to patients and to mice, because of the toxicity, you have to stop giving the drug and have a break. And that break typically is 2 or 3 weeks to allow the body to recover from the harmful side effects of the therapy. And what he noted was that the damage done to the vasculature and the tumors was also repairing itself. And so he came up with the idea that maybe if you lower the dose of the chemotherapy, you don't give the maximum tolerated dose, because what you want to do is give the drug more frequently.
Right.
Maybe give it every week instead of every 3 weeks, or give it every 3 days, or even every day. But if you do that, you can't give the maximum tolerated dose. You would kill people. So this came. He came up with the idea of smaller doses of drug each time you give the drug, but you give the drug more frequently, and you don't have these very long breaks. And so that idea, I would say, came about as a result of the discussion that I had with him a number of years earlier, where I asked him, shouldn't chemotherapy be anti-angiogenic? And then what we came up with was taking that idea of continuous lower dose chemotherapy, what came to be known as metronomic chemotherapy, and now combining it with other therapies, including anti-angiogenic drugs.
And is that now becoming a standard?
It is not. It is not standard yet. It's still investigational. But by way of example, there are finally, about 8, 9, 10 that I'm aware of, large randomized phase 3 clinical trials around the world evaluating in patients the concept of lower dose continuous chemotherapy. And there's a paper that will be coming out very shortly in a journal called Lancet, which you're very familiar with. It's a very large trial undertaken in the Netherlands by a group called the Dutch Colorectal Cancer Group, and they evaluated a version of metronomic chemotherapy plus an anti-angiogenic drug in metastatic colorectal cancer patients, and that trial is a positive trial.
So tell me, Bob, what's the most exciting thing in cancer treatment today?
I'd say the most exciting thing for sure is finally the successful development of drugs and therapies that harness and exploit the body's immune system to fight cancer. This is a very old idea. It's been around for almost a century, I would say, or more. And there have been all sorts of attempts over the years of getting the immune system to fight cancer. And historically, it's worked really well in mice, and then typically it goes into patients, as so often the case, and has not worked well. But finally, over the last few years, a series of strategies based on a series of discoveries made by many groups around the world have resulted in the first successful immune therapies. But what's different about these immune therapies is that the effects that they're causing in some cases are unprecedented. They're really
amazing.
In a
positive sense.
In a positive sense, yeah. And by that I mean long-term disease control, possibly cure in patients, for example, that have malignant melanoma, renal cell carcinoma, kidney cancer, non-small cell lung cancer, possibly.
Well, Bob, thank you so much for being here.
We're very happy that we had on Science Studios time Dr. Robert Kerbel from the Sunnybrook Health Sciences Center in Toronto, Canada. Very fascinating show, and thanks to Norma Martinez, our producer.
My pleasure. Thank you.
For the audience out there, you know fine well we'll be back next week with another program. Take care. Bye-bye.